This Sunday, we are confronted by one of the most endearing and most alluring little parables in all of Scripture, maybe in all of literature. How it fits with the rest of the lessons is not entirely clear, at least to me, nor is it clear how the lesson in Matthew fits with the other assigned readings for the day, Philippians, our psalm, and so on. Dark sayings from old, of old indeed. But the collision of order and answer, of beckoning and response, has to haunt. A man has two sons. Already, the plot is thickened with rivalry, with competition, with family intrigue. Then the preaching of the gospel occurs. The vintner tells something. It is a statement that beckons, not formally a question or even an invitation, simply a command, go. He commands, Schweitzer would be pleased, go and live, go and work, go and love, go and prune, go and pluck, go and tend your garden, go up, up and go. Every day and every Lord's Day, the word arises to us, singeing our nostrils. Go. The day accosts us with a challenge to the good, a choice, if Dewey is right, a choice between goods. You know, I have a feeling about a feeling abroad. I think some of us sometimes have the sinking feeling that things are not going so well, that things are adrift or worse. We see war wounds that do not heal. We see environmental gashes that we rue, ice melting, melting, melting. We watch another attempt to bring expanding gambling to the Commonwealth and wonder, is this the very best we can do? Our own best selves? We see an economy that leaves out, as James Walters said this week, 14 million people, the equivalent of the total population of New England, maybe twice that, when you get everybody counted. We see a beloved country and respected government that can't seem to organize a two-car funeral. We have a certain feeling. And to top it all off, the Red Sox are not always winning every day. You know, I think there's an ennui abroad, a languishing in doldrums of pervasive malaise. So when the word comes, come Sunday, up, go, you, work, vineyard, today, we are very tempted to pull up the covers, sleep in, call in sick, drive in late, and more so, we're just not really sure we can do anything about these apparently irremediable driftings. What difference does it make what I do? So, says son number one, I will not go. Son number two doesn't go. He just evades the compliant, not the defiant one. Number two says, yes, Mrs. Cleaver, but in the end, he doesn't go. He never meant to. He just doesn't like conflict. Well, who does? But the first son has a change of heart. I find this so encouraging, heartening, lovely. Up front, he says, no, no, no way, no way, Jose. He's defiant, and he's willing to say it. I don't think so, Mr. Vintner, Mr. Father, Mr. Voice, Mr. Life, Mr. Daytime. I think I will just turn in my ticket. Thanks, but no thanks. But he has a change of heart. Will you notice with me that the main thing we want to know is not told to us? We want to know what changed the heart? What did the trick? What sealed the deal? What moved the lever? And the scripture responds, "Address not known." In other words, shrouded it is in mystery. So we are not only free, but required to imagine, to speculate, and I plan to take that full freedom today with my dear colleague and friend, Dr. Scott Allen Jarrett. We do not know what brought the change of heart, but I know what can change a heart. Beauty. An experience of the beautiful can change the heart. A thank you note, a sunrise, a poem, a violin sonata, a student writing on our memory board outside, "I saw the planes hit from my fourth grade window." There is a beauty in that memory of innocence lost. When you come to church on Sunday, you may be saying, "No, no, I will not." You may not be willing to have any change, let alone a change in the heart. It is in that very condition that John Wesley went in the rain to Aldersgate Street. "No, I will not go to the vineyard," said he. "Not today." But you get to church and beauty. Sun through stained glass, organ meditation, word fitly spoken, Bach cantata. Music can say things that words never can. Beauty is like that. Help me out, Dr. Jarrett. Help me out.
Well, actually, Dean Hill, Bach suggests his own answer for the source of Son Number One's change of heart. With a spirit of beauty, perhaps it is indeed a spirit of beauty. That is to say, the angels encamped around Son Number One. Angels. Surrounded by us in the windows here, angels and saints, they are the very picture of beauty. Today's cantata celebrates these spirits of beauty and light, the angels. Originally written for the festival of St. Michael on September 29th, our cantata today commemorates the victory of Michael the Archangel over Satan as depicted in the book of Revelation. The first movement the cantata today. It brims with joyful celebration, complete with trumpets and timpani, and in a light, jovial dance style. Any of the jagged depictions of the battle are replaced by the brilliance of the celebration. Here there are no fugues, no demanding complexities of the ear. We hear the voice of Bach's finest expressions of jubilation. As the cantata proceeds, Bach takes the anticipated turn inward, to we, the person in the pew. As if to say, we acknowledge and celebrate the great things that the Lord has brought to pass, but now we mark the ways in which the Lord continues to work on our behalf, in our living, in our working, our sleeping, our loving, and yes, in our departing. The central aria of the cantata, Gottes Engel weichen nie, or God's angels never retreat, these airy beings, the angels, are depicted as they watch over our every need, preventing us from danger and temptation. You'll notice in the lightness of the string playing and the string writing, you'll notice the angelic voice of soprano Margot Rood. The second half of the cantata reminds us that in our departing, God's angels will usher us to Abraham's bosom, just as he did with Elijah and the fiery chariot. You see, Bach is always teaching us a Bible lesson and cross-referencing himself in his Bible. Our dependence on the angels becomes clearer in the final duet, "Seid wachsam, ihr heiligen Wächter," "Be vigilant, you holy watchmen." The instrument, the bassoon, takes the role of the lone watchman in his nightly rounds, protecting us from Satan's snare. The vocalist of the duet, sing to the bassoon, "Be watchful, care for us, and their urging is depicted in the coloratura of the line. The cantata concludes with the famous chorale, Herzlich Lieb, which some Marsh Chapel congregants will recognize as the chorale that concludes the St. John Passion. In the chorale, God's angels usher us to heaven when we meet our end, ever present and ever vigilant. So who can tell the source of beauty behind Son Number One's change of heart? Perhaps God's angels are guiding Son Number One. Or perhaps it's the voice of Lincoln from the window there, invoking the better angels of our nature. Or perhaps it's all the same, a shared and a common beauty, ready and available.
You know, Scott, sometimes we come in saying no, and we leave saying yes. What changes the heart, pierces, transforms the heart? Angelic beauty does. It does. It whispers, reminds. There are a lot of things wrong, but there are a lot of things right. Somebody wrote this cantata, sheer beauty. Somebody practiced and taught it, sheer beauty. Someone sang it and played it, sheer beauty. And here we are, and here you are, and here I am. Music can say things that words never can.